And Radio Derb is on the air. Same deal as the last 2 weeks, listeners. This is the third week of my three-week vacation off the grid in China. This week's podcast, like the previous 2 weeks, has been pre-recorded and kept under lock and key in the subterranean vaults at VDare.com World Headquarters. Being, in the nature of things, unable to comment on anything topical, I shall do what I did those previous 2 weeks. Stitch together some segments from the first 8 years of Radio Derb, the years 2004 to 2012. As before, these are actual clips from the actual sound files, all of which are archived on my personal website. Each clip will be bracketed here with little pip sounds, thus. And as with the previous 2 weeks' podcasts, this one is themed. The September 13th theme was immigration. The September 20th theme was national politics. This week's theme is the culture, loosely defined to mean commentary on topics other than immigration and politics. Topics like, for example, show business.
Let's go on with the show!
Part of the fun of being a conservative is pointing out how very unprogressive some progressive heroes of the past were. Early 20th century progressives all favoured eugenics. 19th century abolitionists wanted to send the freed blacks back to Africa, and so on. Well, when I did my teacher training course back in 1967, this guy wasn't merely progressive, he was a progressive's progressive. In 2004, some of his views were, what's the word? Oh yes, problematic. I doubt many Americans outside the world of professional educationists have heard of Summerhill. It is a so-called progressive school, founded in England in 1924 by an eccentric Freudian named A.S. Neale. Neale's philosophy of education was liberal in the extreme. He felt that children should not be coerced into doing anything at all, certainly not into attending lessons. Aside from Freud, Neale's other guiding star was the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Like Rousseau, Neale believed that children were innately wise and realistic, and that their natures were only spoiled by adult intervention. Like Freud, he believed that difficult children had been made difficult by the environment of the traditional family and school. Neale's 1962 book, whose title is Summerhill, A Radical Approach to Education, has for 40 years served as a ruling text for progressive educators. Well, a new edition of this book has just appeared, but with half of Neale's original text left out. The book has been Baudelaireized. Here's a sample of what has been cut. Neale's claim that, quote, Summerhill has not turned out a single homosexual, because Summerhill children do not suffer from a guilt complex about masturbation, end quote. Oh dear. What was the height of progressive thinking back in 1962 is now the depth of political incorrectness. It's not easy being progressive. Are the Rolling Stones part of American culture? I passed the commentary that follows in May of 2005. A year later, in April 2006, the Stones gave a concert in China. So I guess they're part of
international culture.
Time is on my side, sang Mick Jagger back in 1964. The way the Stones were getting through birds, booze and drugs back then, it didn't actually look as though time was on their side. You would have had to take long odds on a bet that any of them would still be alive 41 years later, never mind up to the rigours of a world concert tour. Here they are, though, three of them at any rate, Mick, Keith and Charlie, on our TV screens to announce yet another world tour, mumbling incoherently at us, just as they used to do back when Barry Goldwater was running for president. If their spoken words are anything to judge by, the road of excess does not lead to the Palace of Wisdom, as promised by William Blake. Neither, however, does it necessarily lead to perdition, as our parents assured us. What it apparently leads to in this very strange age we are living through is the uppermost reaches of the bourgeoisie, with huge country houses, legions of servants, yachts, and solid investment portfolios. Memo to rockers. If you want to be taken seriously as a counterculture icon, at least have the good grace to die young from an overdose of something.
I don't comment on movies much because I don't watch many movies. Mike Judge's movie, Idiocracy, got my attention back in 2006, though.
Not everybody in showbiz is left-wing, believe it or not. Take, for example, producer Mike Judge, the guy who gave us Beavis and Butthead, Office Space and King of the Hill. You may not like Judge's comedy, it's kind of crude, but he's a Reaganite conservative, and he's done more lampooning of political correctness than anybody this side of Radio Derb, except possibly for the South Park people. Well, Judge's latest movie is titled Idiocracy. The story is that an average Joe is put into deep hibernation. He wakes up 500 years in the future, and he finds that all the smart people have disappeared. The whole world is populated by morons, fed by the stupidest kind of pop culture. And our hero is now the smartest guy on the planet. So, wait a minute. You mean to say that Judge actually believes that some people are smarter than others? And that differential breeding rates could eliminate smart people and put the dimwits in charge of everything? And that this would be a bad thing? Plainly, this guy is some kind of Nazi. No wonder Fox is doing its best to deep-six the movie. Don't expect to see it advertised in your local newspaper. The promotional budget is zero. The great mystery here is why the Fox execs commissioned this movie in the first place. They must be really, really stupid. But if one of our major media corporations is run by terminally stupid people, doesn't that sort of make the movie's point?
One of the glories of American culture is our popular songs, and one of the greatest contributors in that realm was Pennsylvania-born Stephen Foster, Floroit, the middle of the 19th century. One of Foster's works was adopted as the official state song of Florida in 1935. I believe it still is the state song, or one of them, but the lyrics were causing trouble in 2007 and have since been modified. Here's my commentary from the December 14th, 2007 podcast.
Yeah.
That was a 1955 recording of the high school choir of Stanton, a little town by Lake Weir, down there in the middle of Florida. The song they're singing is, of course, The Old Folks at Home. In my opinion, it's a very lovely song. If you just read the words, which are all right there on the Wikipedia page for the song, you will see that they stand up very well just as verse, even without the tune. Here, for example, is the last stanza and chorus, just read as plain verse. One little hut among de bushes, one dat I love, still sadly to my memory rushes, no matter where I rove. When will I see de bees a-hummin', all round de comb? When will I hear de banjo strummin', down in my good old home? All de world am sad and dreary, everywhere I roam. Oh, darkies, how my heart grows weary, far from the old folks at home. Now, as nostalgia poems go, I'd put that right up there with my own favourite, Thomas Hood's I Remember, I Remember. It's poignant and moving. Since most of the Suwannee River is in Florida, The Old Folks at Home has been Florida's official state song since 1935. No longer. Governor Charlie Crist asked for it not to be sung at his inauguration earlier this year. The problem is, you see, that the original lyrics were in 19th century black dialect. Why this should be a problem for anybody, I don't understand. Does someone think that 19th century African Americans did not have a dialect of their own? What, they all spoke like Dr. Huxtable? The soldiers in Kipling's poems speak in dialect, and nobody minds that. George Eliot wrote a novel whose characters all speak in Derbyshire dialect, if you don't mind me mentioning it, but nobody ever minded that either. Stephen Foster, the popular music genius who actually wrote Old Folks at Home, was a Pennsylvania boy who supported the Union in the Civil War. Does anyone care? Does anyone care that we're being stripped of our past, of everything that once belonged to us and united us and made us aware of ourselves as a nation, by a passel of Leninist busybodies and professional complainers? Governor Charlie Crist, you are a damn disgrace to the Republican Party, and to the state of Florida, and to the United States of America, and to Western civilization. If the people of Florida, black and white alike, still have any patriotic feeling, they should impeach you. I see that you're promoting a campaign to find a new state song. May I suggest the International?
One of the occasionally recurring themes in my commentary is an affection for what Grile Marcus called the old, weird America. That affection surfaced on the podcast in May 2008.
Okay, speaking of polygamy, how about this sect down in Texas in that little ranch at El Dorado? Texas authorities raided the place a couple of weeks ago on a telephone tip about sexual abuse, which was never substantiated. Now they've taken 400 children away from the only homes they've known to put them in foster care. Well, I'm against it. I have a little personal history here. When I was a young schoolteacher, I worked a year in a really bad, old-style urban slum in Liverpool, England. The kids at that school were classified as ESN, which stood for Educationally subnormal, which meant that, while there wasn't anything actually wrong with them, they'd fallen way behind in their schooling, mostly by a combination of low IQ and really bad home environments. I got to know the school nurse and the welfare and liaison officers from the local police force and services really well, and I heard all their stories, and I taught some of the kids that the stories were about. One thing everyone always said, which I confirmed, was that in all but the most horribly abusive homes, the kids loved their parents and wanted to stay with them, and were broken-hearted to be taken away from them. I remember one case of two twin boys, they would be aged about 12 or 13, who showed up at school with bruised faces once too often, so child welfare went round to their house. The squalor there was indescribable, they told me later. The feature that I remember best was that the father had pulled up alternate boards from the stairs that led up to the upper story to use them for firewood. So you had to kind of hop up the stairs, missing out the gaps. Well, welfare services took the twins away, but those boys screamed and clung to their mum and dad and begged not to be taken from the home they knew and the parents who, however misguidedly, they loved. "I'm in anguish over it," the school nurse told me. "I really don't know if we did the right thing." Well, a polygamy cult can be rough. I understand that. It's rough on a woman who has no kind of independence, nor the alternative satisfaction of a man dedicated to her alone. It's also rough on the young men, most of whom get voted off the ranch to keep the numbers balancing right. Did they have to take away those kids, though? Were those cultists minding anybody's business but their own? Do you remember that phrase, the old, weird America? The old, weird America. Couldn't they have left us just a little bit of the old, weird America? These bureaucrats and busybodies and accountants? No, of course they couldn't. Heaven forbid people should live the way they want to live in 21st century America. Weird people? Lock 'em up!
Just a follow-up to that, the justices of both the Texas Third Appeal Court and the Texas State Supreme Court eventually agreed with me. In my May 8th podcast, 2009, I made some scathing remarks about the state of poetry nowadays. That was on the accession of Britain's new poet laureate, Carol Ann Duffy, of whom we read on the Poetry Foundation website that, quote, "Her verses are typically spoken in the voices of the urban disaffected, people on the margins of society, who harbour resentments and grudges against the world," end quote. A few weeks later came the bicentenary of Alfred Lord Tennyson. I took the opportunity to pay tribute to a real poet, one of the greatest.
As well as being the 200th anniversary of Haydn's passing, this is also the 200th birthday, just last Thursday in fact, of Alfred Lord Tennyson, one of the half-dozen best poets the English language has produced this past 1200 years. Tennyson's not much in fashion nowadays, but that just tells you what lousy times we live in. Here is Tennyson at the top of his form. You need to know a bit of background. The poem I'm just going to read is a poem within a poem, a short poem in a very long one. The long poem is called The Princess. A prince loves a princess. He is wounded in battle, but the princess takes him in and nurses him back to health, sitting up with him all night. In the middle of the night, the prince wakes in a semi-delirium and hears the princess reading out loud to herself from, quote, a volume of the poets of her land. This is the poem she's reading. The person Danae it mentions is from Greek mythology. Danae was shut up in a tower by her dad so that she wouldn't get pregnant, but the god Zeus came to her through the window in a shower of golden rain and impregnated her anyway. All right, here's the poem. Now sleeps the crimson petal, now the white. Nor waves the cypress in the palace walk, nor winks the gold fin in the porphyry font. The firefly wakens. Waken thou with me. Now droops the milk-white peacock like a ghost, and, like a ghost, she glimmers on to me. Now lies the earth all Danae to the stars, and all thy heart lies open unto me. Now slides the silent meteor on, and leaves a shining furrow as thy thoughts in me. Now folds the lily all her sweetness up, and slips into the bosom of the lake. So fold thyself, my dearest, thou, and slip into my bosom, and be lost in me. Poetry just doesn't get any better than that.
In October 2010, I took a look at our elites, and at elites in general.
What do you think of elites, listener? My own view of the matter is that I rather like them. I'm sure, at any rate, that a healthy society can't get along without some kind of elite. Unfortunately, while I like the idea of elites in general, I detest the elite that we actually have at this point in our history. Well, that's just me. I raised the topic because there's been some to-ing and fro-ing on the opinion websites about elitism. This is fallout from an October 2nd posting by Jacob Weisberg on Slate. Weisberg's a lefty, so of course he was poking fun at Republicans who claim to be anti-elitist. John McCain in the recent presidential campaign, for example. Quote from Weisberg. Thus did the son and grandson of admirals, a millionaire who couldn't remember how many houses he owned, accuse his mixed-race opponent, raised by a single mother and only a few years past paying off his student loans, of being the real elite candidate in the campaign. End quote. Yeah, that's cute, Jake, and I can't find it in me to rise to McCain's defence. I'm still working with one eye, having plucked the other one out when voting for John McCain in 2008. You're missing the point, though, Jake. What elite status in the USA is really about is college education. The surest path to influence and wealth remains a degree from one of our top universities. Here's a recent study. It's out of Harvard University, as it happens. A recent study tallying up the number of degrees held by members of the U.S. Senate. Top five schools. Harvard, 35 degrees in the Senate. Yale, 23. University of Virginia, 10. Stanford, 8. Georgetown, 8. No other school has more than 7 degrees. Politically, of course, we are at the moment going through a spasm of anti-elitism, or at least in the Radio Derb spirit, hostility to the elites we currently have, if not to the notion of elitism in all its generality. Surveying history, I think I detect the following general rule about elites. When things are going well for the mass of ordinary citizens, which means in practice that the country is getting richer year by year, people will put up with any kind of elite. Aristocrats, robber barons, military types, Harvard graduates, we don't care. When economic progress stalls, though, we take it out on our elites. If things go far enough, we end up with a new elite. That's what we're heading into. With the national pie shrinking, at least for the next decade or so, the factional fighting for shares of the pie will get more intense, and resentment against those perceived to have too big a share will rise. We're in for some social discord, folks. We may come out of it with a whole new elite. Perhaps one that actually likes America and puts the interests of American citizens over the interests of foreigners. Who knows?
The doctrine of multiculturalism, I opined in this piece from February 2011, quote, may be the greatest single act of mass folly since the Children's Crusade, end quote. Now, 8.5 years later, I think I may have understated the case.
Anti-multiculturalism is busting out all over. Last October, Angela Merkel, the bodacious Chancellor of Germany, told a gathering of her party's youth wing that the whole guest worker deal had gone sour. Quote from her, we kidded ourselves a while. We said, they won't stay. After some time they will be gone. But this isn't reality. And of course, the approach to build a multicultural society and to live side by side and to enjoy each other has failed. Utterly failed. Do you mind if I do it in German? This kind of thing sounds so much better in German. Quote, Multikulti hat Deutschland in die Irre geführt. Multikulti ist gescheitert. Well, she got a standing ovation. A public opinion poll taken a few days previously by a respectable German think tank had turned up 13% of Germans saying they'd welcome a Führer. Ah, the bitter fruits of multiculturalism. Then, last weekend, up spoke David Cameron, Britain's conservative Prime Minister, in Munich, of all places, on a public panel discussion with Angela Merkel, of all people, she of the formidable Teutonic embonpoint. Quote from Dave, under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we have encouraged different cultures to live separate lives apart from each other and the mainstream. We have failed to provide a vision of society to which they feel they want to belong. End quote. And now, for the trifecta, up limps Nicolas Sarkozy, President of France, to explain it once more. Quote from him in a TV interview this Thursday, quote, if you come to France, you accept to melt into a single community, which is the national community, and if you do not want to accept that, you cannot be welcome in France. We have been too concerned about the identity of the person who was arriving, and not enough about the identity of the country that was receiving him, end quote. Unfortunately, Angela, Dave, and Nick are all dancing around the main point. If you import millions of people from a very different culture into a modern welfare state, under modern conditions of cheap travel and instant communications, there isn't much reason for them to assimilate into the national culture. There is doubly no reason when the high panjandrums of the national culture seem not to like it very much themselves and go around wringing their hands and apologising for their nation's past misdeeds. So, of course, large numbers of your imported guest workers are going to settle happily into permanent ethnic enclaves and give the finger to the national culture, except when it's time to draw a dole. Here's another quote from Cameron on that same occasion. Quote, "Frankly, we need a lot less of the passive tolerance of recent years and much more active, muscular liberalism." Yes, we do. But why do we? Britain used to be famous for passive tolerance. It used to be the nation of all nations in which the citizen could pass through his whole life without bothering much about the state. Where is the state in the novels of Jane Austen or Thomas Hardy? The reason Britain could be like that was that it was ethnically homogeneous, and that remained true well past the middle of the last century. When I was growing up in the English Midlands 50 years ago, we thought a Scotsman was exotic. Now, Britain's multi-ethnic, multicultural, multiracial, and multi-religious. Not just a seasoning like the salt in your stew, any healthy society has always had that, but great blocks and slabs of alienness. And Cameron's right. In a modern state, with minorities that large and that different, passive tolerance won't work. Or to put it another way, Britain can't be Britain. Out with passive tolerance, in with muscular liberalism. Out with the state leaving citizens alone, in with ever more of the state bossing citizens around. Out with liberty, in with enforced political correctness. All this could have been foreseen, and was foreseen, by statesmen like the late great Enoch Powell. The British and the French and the Germans went ahead anyway, filling up the slums of their cities with people who don't like them and who see politics in terms of zero-sum ethnic games. Multiculturalism may be the greatest single act of mass folly since the Children's Crusade. What a pity it's taken these dimwit politicians half a century to notice.
I try to keep a calm and balanced tone in my podcast commentary, but it's not always easy. Some news stories just make me really, really angry. Here is an instance. In this segment from February 2012, I think you can, if you listen carefully, hear the sound of my teeth grinding.
This one has me really steamed, I must admit. You might want to turn down the volume on your iPod here. I can't guarantee I won't break into uncontrollable screaming at some point in this segment. Next Tuesday, the trial of 19-year-old Darren Ravi opens in New Brunswick, New Jersey. If found guilty, Mr. Ravi could go to jail for 10 years. What did Darren Ravi do? Well, he was a freshman roommate at Rutgers University with a chap named Tyler Clementi. Clementi was homosexual, and not a closeted one. He didn't make much of a secret of it. Why would he? Our young people are taught from kindergarten that gay is just as good as straight, that Heather has two mommies, and that homosexuals should be proud. My local high school has a club for homosexual students. Anyone who's embarrassed or ashamed about being homosexual hasn't been paying attention for about 30 years. And in fact, Clementi wasn't. In those first 3 weeks of his freshman year, he attended at least one meeting of the Rutgers Students Bisexual, Gay and Lesbian Alliance. Well, a year last September, Darren Ravi and another freshman, Molly Way, used a webcam to secretly watch Clementi kissing a young man that Clementi had picked up. After watching the video, Ravi gossiped about it on Twitter. Quote, "I saw him making out with a dude. Yay." 3 days after that, Clementi committed suicide by jumping from the George Washington Bridge.
Whether this had any connection at all to the webcam incident is not known. That Darren Ravi thought his prank might drive Clementi to suicide is preposterous. That he intended that result is preposterosity squared. The homosexualists were up in arms nonetheless, and every damn fool politician in New Jersey joined in the hue and cry. Chris Christie, who I think less of every time he opens his fat mouth, quote, "I don't know how those two folks are going to sleep at night, knowing that they contributed to driving that young man to that alternative," end quote. They don't know that, Governor, and neither do you, and neither does anyone. They played a trivial prank. Clementi killed himself. Cause and effect are not obvious, and are certainly not established to any fair evidentiary standards. The even more dim-witted Senator Frank Lautenberg has introduced national legislation that, quote, would require colleges and universities that receive federal student aid to adopt codes of conduct that prohibit bullying and harassment of students, end quote. So now it's going to be a federal crime for students to pull pranks. What the hell country is this? North Korea? What's going to be the next federal offence on the statute book? Forgetting to feed your goldfish? The New Jersey prosecutors are not actually charging Darren Ravi in connection with Clementi's death. How could they? Since you'd have to be even stupider than Chris Christie and Frank Lautenberg to think that any such thing was on his mind. The actual charges are invasion of privacy, bias intimidation, witness tampering, and evidence tampering. The last two items are just BS. Invasion of privacy is a reasonable description of what Ravi did, though you need to be borderline insane, which apparently New Jersey is, to think that it's a suitable matter for a full court trial, with multi-year sentences in the balance. The truly poisonous charge is that second one, bias intimidation. This is basically a charge that Ravi had bad thoughts, that he looked down on homosexuals and invaded Clementi's privacy on those grounds. It's a charge of thought crime. The Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office actually offered Ravi a plea deal back in May. If he'd plead guilty, they'd give him 5 years in the slammer. If not, he'd go to trial and face 10, if found guilty on the thought crime charge. Ravi turned down the deal, and the trial starts next week. Once again, here's what Ravi did. He used a webcam to film his roommate kissing a guy. Then he tweeted that, quote, "I saw him making out with a dude. Yay." And for this, we're talking fives and tens of years in jail. Not really because of the trivial thing he did, but for having bad thoughts. This is the most horrible, most shameful prosecution I've heard of for a long time. Homosexuals are less than 4% of our population, perhaps only 1%. And rather than face down the shrieking hysteria of this tiny minority, we are turning our jurisprudence upside down and wrecking the life of a harmless young man in an effort to appease the mob. From all that I've read, and I've read a good deal about this case, Ian Parker's report in the February 6th New Yorker is a good starting point. Tyler Clementi was a chronically unhappy young man. He killed himself for reasons not known. That's an awful thing. I speak as the father of two teenagers. It is not the purpose of the federal government to try to prevent unhappy people from killing themselves, though. Nor is it the purpose of the judiciary, when such a thing happens, to hunt out a scapegoat and drag him through the courts at the behest of rich, noisy nuisance lobbies. "You can't go to jail for what you're thinking," went the old song. In New Jersey, you can, if you're thinking unkind thoughts about homosexuals. This prosecution is a disgrace to New Jersey, a shame on the people of New Jersey and on their gibbering, pandering fool politicians. The charges against Darren Ravi are nothing less than totalitarian. Now, I'm going to start the uncontrollable screaming. But it's okay, I'll do it off mic.
That's all I have for you in that third and final trip down memory lane. Next week I shall once again be reporting on current events as usual. Assuming the CHICOMs let me out and US Customs and Immigration Services let me in. Which, given the many unkind things I have said about Chinese communism and US immigration policy across several decades, cannot be guaranteed. Those conditions permitting, there will be more from Radio Derb next week.